A disturbing increase in lung cancer among women.
The best way to have smoking cessation.
Can you safely or even helpfully occlude one part of the heart?
And eating eggs in China.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your look at the weekly medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This will be posted on May 25th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should start with the New England Journal of Medicine. A look at a rather disturbing, I think more than rather disturbing, increase in lung cancer among women. These investigators took a look at the National Health Interview Survey from 1970 to 2016, so really an abundance of data. And they looked at the age-specific incidence of lung cancer among both men and women and of different age groups over that time period. Also, they took a look at different ethnic groups. It used to be that it was always the men who had the lung cancer and the men who were dying of lung cancer, and now that's essentially flipped. Now women are actually experiencing it at higher rates than men are. So they've turned around over that time period and also has reversed among non-Hispanic whites and Hispanics born since the mid-1960s. When we take a look at confounders in this particular, all these different cohorts, we're not able to really discern why this is happening.
What's happened is over the decades, it's been decreasing across both genders, but it's decreased much more in men than it has in women. And you might say, well, that's because women are smoking more. And there is some truth to that. However, what this study shows is that that alone does not account for this. And it suggests that there's some other possible cause. One of the possible causes is the fact that women may be more sensitive to the effect of cigarettes. There's some genuine concern that they are more predisposed to developing cancer if they smoke the same amount as men do.
Very disturbing. And it's unclear to me exactly what we're going to do to intervene here.
One of the obvious things is we just need to stop cigarette smoking altogether. That will obviously decrease the rate substantially. But having said that, even in this study, factors other than active tobacco use accounted for 15% of the lung cancers in women and 10% in men. As you suggest, we need to have more information to figure out why the discrepancy and what we can do to affect that.
This segues us very nicely into one you're going to talk about also in the New England Journal of Medicine, a so-called pragmatic trial of interventions to stop smoking.
At first, I kind of yawned when I saw this because we've talked about smoking cessation before and the best way to make it happen. But what this study did, it's very pragmatic. They looked at 54 different companies in which there were over 6,000 smokers. Now, these weren't people that signed up to be enrolled in a study. They reached out to these 6,000 smokers and said, okay, we're going to offer you one of five different things. One is the usual care. That is, they just gave them information. The second is that they would give them either drugs or e-cigarettes. The third is they give them e-cigarettes alone. And the fourth and fifth is they would give them some sort of incentive as well. They'd pay them in addition to providing drugs for smoking cessation. When they reached out to 6,000 people, there were only about 11 or 1,200 that really expressed an interest at all in participating. So that's only 20%. And then when they looked at 6 months abstinence rates across the entire 6,000, it was pretty low. It ranged from 0.5% with usual care to only about 3% in those that received incentives. And what they did show was those that received incentives were more likely to be abstinent after 6 months than those provided usual care, that's just counseling, nicotine substitution or drugs, and e-cigarettes added nothing at all.
So, gosh, there's so many lessons to take away here. The whole thing about e-cigarettes, I guess I'm not really surprised by that. I'm astonished, however, at the relative lack of interest in smoking cessation.
And that's why this pragmatic trial is helpful, because the previous trials enrolled people that were interested and said, gosh, I really do want to quit. What can you do to help me? Less than 20% said, well, I'll follow through. So, Elizabeth, that is disappointing.
It's disappointing. I wonder how to overcome that. We certainly have plenty of information out there proving just how deleterious this habit is.
In fact, this still remains the most preventable cause of mortality and significant morbidity worldwide. And Elizabeth, I agree. It's dumbfounding to me why 80% of people say, yes, I know it causes cancer. And yes, I know it contributes to cardiovascular disease and it'll take 10 to 15 years off my life. But no, I'm not interested in stopping. I don't get it.
I don't get it either. That's, to me, the big follow-up with regard to this particular study.
For those people that were engaged that said, gosh, I do want to quit, still the abstinence rate was less than 15%, even using those five different techniques. But again, the incentives, providing some monetary incentive, in addition to using some nicotine substitute or drug substitute, seemed to be the best strategy.
All right. From here, why don't we turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is what's called surgical occlusion of the left atrial appendage. Okay. What is that? For those who aren't medical among us, that's this little flap of extra tissue that's on the left atrium, that chamber that allows filling of blood to come through into the heart before the ventricle, of course, pumps it out to the rest of the body. So what's really interesting is there sometimes they occlude that. They actually sort of wall it off during surgery for other cardiac reasons. In this really enormous study that was done at the Mayo Clinic, they had almost 76,000 patients who underwent cardiac surgery. Just over 4,000 had occlusion of this left atrial appendage while that surgery was taking place. They took a look at the long-term outcomes from these folks, and they basically showed that occlusion of the left atrial appendage compared without doing that resulted in significant reductions in stroke and all-cause mortality. So to me, the take-home of this trial seems to be really clear. Gosh, if you're in there doing something else, it's probably a good idea to occlude the appendage.
For those people that have atrial fibrillation, an irregular heart rhythm where the upper chamber doesn't beat synchronously but just kind of quivers, those people are at 5 times higher risk of having stroke. What's thought to happen is in that left atrial appendage, because there's not continuous flow of blood, a clot can form and it can dislodge and go to the brain. Hence, anticoagulants are used in these individuals, and it decreases the risk of stroke by about 70%. But a lot of people either don't take them or don't take them regularly, or even those that do, sometimes they're not properly anticoagulated. So in those individuals, as you suggest, occluding the left atrial appendage in this particular study decreased the risk of stroke and mortality by about 30%. Now, they looked in the two different groups, those that had pre-existing atrial fibrillation and those that didn't, and it seemed to really only be beneficial in those that had pre-existing atrial fibrillation. One of the downsides was for the patients that did have occlusion of the left atrial appendage, they were more likely to develop ongoing atrial fibrillation and be hospitalized for it in the future. So there's a small downside, but in comparing the two, I think the risk of stroke is a much bigger danger. And if you can prevent that 30% of the time by doing something during a cardiac procedure that's already going to be done, then I think that's an indication for doing it.
Well, I think it's really interesting here. We were talking about a little bit. Gosh, what in the world is that appendage doing anyway?
Some people would say it's not terribly dissimilar from an appendix, as you have it, but doesn't contribute very much.
We'll move from here then to something in the journal Heart, a look at egg consumption and whether that's a good thing.
I'm glad that we're talking about this. Just previous week where someone was asking me, well, are eggs healthy or not? They increase your dietary intake of cholesterol. On the other hand, they have some positive effects. Even though egg eaters have a higher LDL cholesterol, they also have a higher HDL cholesterol, and there are antioxidants in there and proteins as well. 20 years ago, there's a big bash on eggs, but there have been some data that suggests that eating eggs perhaps is not harmful, but may be helpful, and that's what this Chinese study also shows. It was interesting in that they had about 500,000 adults that they had enrolled from 2004 to 2008. These were adults aged 30 to 79 from 10 different diverse sites in China. And they asked them a simple question. Do you eat the recommendation? The recommendation was to eat about one egg per day, or do you eat few to no eggs? And they compared the two, looking at over a course of about 9 years, what their risk was of stroke and ischemic heart disease. And the egg eaters, again, they were eating one egg a day, had a lower risk of cardiovascular disease, about 11% lower risk, a lower risk of stroke, whether that be hemorrhagic stroke or ischemic stroke, and a lower risk of ischemic heart disease. Where it had its biggest effect was in hemorrhagic stroke, which has a much higher incidence in a Chinese population than it does in the American population. This shows that at least in the Chinese population, eating an egg a day, that's a moderate level of egg consumption, was significantly associated with a lower risk of cardiovascular disease.
I'd really like to repeat this study in a Caucasian population because, of course, I'm vested in that and in other populations. We certainly have seen that there are differences in these dietary interventions among people with slightly different genomic backgrounds.
And as I mentioned, Americans suffer more from ischemic heart disease and less from hemorrhagic stroke than the Chinese population. And where the egg consumption seemed to have its biggest effect was it lowered the risk of hemorrhagic stroke from about 28%. So I agree with you, Elizabeth. It'd be interesting to see, even though this is a large study, whether this is transferable to other populations.
I guess the other thing that's noteworthy about eggs is that they're a really pretty cheap and not so resource-intensive form of protein.
Absolutely. And again, I want to stress this was a moderate consumption. This is an average of about 0.8 to 1 egg per day. But compared to no egg ingestion, clearly beneficial.
All right. On that note, I think I'm going to talk about the pragmatic smoking study from the New England Journal of Medicine this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.